I call this meeting of the Committee on Housing Finance and Policy to order. Let it be known that we have quorum. So welcome today, members. We have just one bill in front of us and a bipartisan bill at that. So exciting to see two members of opposite sides of the aisle working together and moving this piece of legislation before us. So we're going to get started because we have a list of testifiers, but I guess before that I should probably approve the minutes. So can I see a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes from February 26, 2025.
Representative Nash moves the minutes. Is there any discussion?
Chair, Representative Nash was absent last week.
I
will go ahead and move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen, for the correction. Ooh. any discussion to the motion? All those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right, so we'll move to House File 1268. I'll make the motion that House File 1268 be moved to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Bonner, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's all right, what we'd like to do is move the A5 first to get it in the shape we'd like it, the author's amendment.
Absolutely. Please proceed with your amendment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A5, very briefly, I'll just give you a quick outline of what it does. First, it has some language around cooperatives that are included in Statute 308C. This specific section is being rewritten, is my understanding. So this makes some changes to make sure that we are being cognizant of that. In addition, it adds some comfort language around finalizing the disposition of common elements before a dissolution. It also adds some additional language around fines for bad behavior and the ability to cure that, as well as conflict of interest language updates to make sure they mirror in various sections so that they're nice and crisp and clean. In addition to that, we have the removal of the plain language element, which will very likely be carried in a separate bill for very different reasons. And then finally, we have an agreement that we worked out with the League of Minnesota Cities and AMC around some language at the end that has some work around maintenance and insurance. That was an agreement, and so we're proposing to put that into the bill as well, honoring that agreement. And did I miss anything? Nope, that's it.
Any discussion, members of the committee? If that, I'll change the motion. I renew the motion that Representative Mecklen moves the A5 amendment. So seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. All right. House File 1268, right before you, creates a strong framework of consumer protections for homeowners and solid guardrails to set up association boards and property managers for success. It contains a robust set of policy provisions based on the recommendations of the CIC and HOA Legislative Working Group, of which Representative Mecklen and I are both members. It was comprised of homeowners, boards, property managers, attorneys, industry groups, and organizations that work on behalf of homeowners. The group met a total of 14 times over several months in the interim, with public listening sessions in each corner of the metro to hear from members of the community firsthand. In the past few decades, we have seen an explosion of CICs and associations across the country. While they were once rare, today 82% of new homes in the marketplace are in an HOA, with nearly one in four Minnesotans living in an HOA. With an increase nationally and here at home, our laws have simply not kept pace. The promise of association living has been one of affordable, well-maintained housing that offered home ownership to a wide variety of people in every income level. And for some, that promise delivered. And for others, the reality is one of escalating costs for monthly dues, special assessments for repairs, outrageous restrictions on boards run amok, escalating fines and fees, often for minor infractions, leading to foreclosure, or residents forced to sell when their affordable housing is no longer affordable. Further, Minnesota law often provides little guidance to boards and property managers, and no recourse for homeowners when the American dream, unfortunately, turns into their worst nightmare. The bill before you encapsulates the expertise of work group members and the experiences of homeowners to spell out in plain language a common sense set of reasonable standards to improve Minnesota law, provide necessary guardrails and critical checks and balances to provide consumer protections that place Minnesotans at the center of our work. The bill covers provisions around governance, from open meetings to governing documents, and dissolution to dispute resolution. It clearly spells out a framework for fines, fees, and foreclosures while tackling conflict of interest and the role of municipalities and basic civil rights and freedoms as well. The bill has wide bipartisan support, as you've evidenced here, in the House and in the Senate. Other bills, including some clarifications around registration, enforcement of the policy bill, as well as a task force on insurance that may have costs will travel separately as they may have budget implications, and we know that is a paramount concern in a budget year. So we wanted to make sure those get the vetting they deserve. With that, I'm going to ask nonpartisan staff to do a quick walkthrough of the sections of the bill for members before we get to testimony and questions.
Chair and members, this is Mary Davis from the House Research Department. I'll start at Section 1, which amends the applicability of Chapter 515B. Section 2 deals with the construction and validity of declarations and bylaws, and talks about what to do when there's a conflict between the bylaws and governing documents and this chapter. Section 3 deals with terminations of common interest communities. Section 4 amends the powers and duties of a unit owners associations for an HOA or a CIC. Section 5 amends part of the statute related to the board of directors, officers, and declarant control. Section 6 addresses bylaws and annual reports. Section 7 makes updates to the upkeep of the common interest community, so maintenance and the requirements there. Section 8 makes changes to meeting requirements, annual meeting requirements and other meeting requirements. Section 9 deals with proxy voting and makes changes to the existing statutes. Section 10 addresses assessments for common interest communities, created before August 1 of 2010, and Section 11 makes changes related to assessments that the CIC or HOA does for common interest communities and HOAs created after August 10, 2010. Section 12 will deal with liens for assessments. And I should note, sorry, this is after the author's amendment has been made, so if you're trying to follow along in paper, it won't work because these are the current existing pieces of the bill, not the bill that was printed out, sorry. So this deals with liens. So whenever a lien is placed on an HOA or a CIC, which the association does for fees and fines and things that are owed. The next section, requirements to meet and confer, that's a new section that would be required for HOAs and CICs, kind of a dispute resolution process that they're creating. Legal fees and notice requirements would be a new Section 14, and that would limit legal fees and require notice to homeowners about those legal fees. Section 15 would be disclosure statements. It makes small amendments to the current law for all CICs when they are sold from the declarant, related to the giving information about the laws that affect CICs and HOAs. And then rights of action and retaliation prohibited, and that is some new language related to prohibiting retaliation against a homeowner. Then there would be an Article 2, in addition to what's currently in Article 3, and that article would add new sections of law related to local government preemptions, and it would also amend the interaction between Chapter 308C, which relates to housing cooperatives, and Chapter 515B, most notably moving the effective date on Chapter 508C housing cooperatives out 1 year so that it didn't come into effect in 2025 and instead comes into effect in 2026. And that is everything.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Is there any questions from members of the committee? Thank you. Is there any further testimony before we kick off into testifiers from either you, Representative Bonner, or Representative Meckland? All right. Well, then we'll move into our first testifier. So it'll be Roxanne Young Kimball, followed by Jenny Sanford.
Just for a minute. Don't worry, I won't leave you too far.
Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much and good afternoon, Chair Igo and members of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 1268. My name is Roxanne Young Kimball, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Homeownership Center. We serve as an intermediary for the state of Minnesota that provides training, technical support, and advocacy to further equitable access to homeownership. In this capacity, we work with 30 nonprofit and government entities across the state, helping individuals stabilize their credit, prepare to qualify for a mortgage, purchase a home, and prevent foreclosure through housing counseling services. I served on the legislative working group that contributed to the changes HF 1268 seeks to make. HOAs play a key role in creating pathways to homeownership. When properly managed, HOAs and CICs can enhance community connections, improve housing affordability, and foster democratic engagement. However, through our work with the housing counseling community and participation in the legislative working group, we heard troubling stories about HOAs that are not functioning as intended. In some cases, HOAs are being used to exclude, discriminate, or operate unfairly. During the working group, we heard from hundreds of HOA members, HOA board members, and industry professionals that support the need for the common sense rights in HF 1268, including transparency in HOA CIC operations. Dues-paying members should have access to financial practices and decisions they contribute to without getting charged, and expect reasonable fines for minor rule infractions, like leaving out trash cans one extra day. Access to fair dispute resolution. Homeowners should have access to dispute resolution mechanisms that prevent the escalation of legal costs. Protection of basic freedoms. Homeowners should have the right to operate a business as permitted by the city, park a work vehicle, accommodate a disability, and promote environmental sustainability on their private property that they own, insure, and manage. Disclosures of conflict of interest. Property management companies, board members, and contractors should be required to disclose conflicts of interest in a timely manner to ensure transparency and accountability. And a right to dissolve an HOA and CIC. In communities where no common property exists, such as in some single-family developments that were created due to city requirements, homeowners should have the right to dissolve the HOA. Case in point is Heritage Park in Minneapolis, where a planned unit development was never fully built, no common property was created, and the city has eliminated the zoning requirement for the HOA to continue. Yet the HOA remains, despite the desire of the homeowners, due to the current state statutes that place an unreasonably high barrier on dissolution, requiring 80% of all owners and 80% of all first mortgage holders to approve dissolution. Our organization is committed to supporting the task force recommendations and is actively pursuing funding to develop and deploy an educational curriculum that outlines the unique roles and responsibilities for home purchase in an HOA or CIC to accompany our home stretch homebuyer education curriculum throughout the state. I encourage you to listen to the homeowners who testified throughout the working group and pass the protections included in HF 1268. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Young Kimball. Is there any questions? All right, next on the list will be Jenny Sanford. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Jenny Sanford, and I am the Homeowner Engagement Manager at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. Thank you for your time today. I lead a dedicated team that support homeowners who have purchased through Habitat for Humanity across the 7-county metro area. And our team's goal is to help homeowners develop essential financial management and home maintenance skills, as well as foster community building so that they can thrive in their homes. Habitat has constructed homes in 60 different HOAs, each with its own unique set of governing documents that outline how the board functions and the different community rules. These communities elect boards to interpret and apply the rules and regulations equitably. However, when this process breaks down, homeowners often turn to Habitat for assistance. When homeowners call us about HOA-related concerns, we advise them to contact their board, attend meetings, and review the governing documents. Given the limited consumer protection currently available to homeowners in HOAs, we also recommend visiting the Minnesota State Attorney General's website and contacting Community Associations Institute. While helpful, these resources are not enough to meet the needs of homeowners requesting additional assistance to navigate the complexities of governance. Recently, we received a message from a homeowner who is considering selling her property due to the dissatisfaction with her HOA's management. She expressed that purchasing within an HOA was a mistake. And when we invest in affordable housing, our goal is to ensure long-term successful homeownership. It is disheartening for all parties involved when poor HOA management undermines the success. Our goal is to ensure that the HOA ecosystem is functional and provides a supportive environment where families can thrive. We advocate for the state to establish standards of practice for the HOA boards and enhance consumer protections for community members. We support these changes to prepare HOAs to be successful in the long term. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions from members of the committee? Thank you. All right, next on the list will be Nick Erickson. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota, and I'm always happy to testify in front of this committee on a bipartisan housing bill. By way of background, our members are the community, are the developers, the builders, the remodelers, and all the skilled trade partners that build the communities and places that we all call home. And before I begin, I just want to be clear, under state law, where it is required, HOAs, even with the passage of this bill, will continue to still be created. This will not change. What will change under this law is that a loophole will be closed in which there's a backdoor creation of HOAs by mandating common property. And really, that's why we're here to support this bill today, because it brings about long and overdue reform to the HOAs in Minnesota. It's also a matter of housing affordability. I did address the commission on this topic a few months ago, and before I did meet with our developer members and asked them, what do they see in the field when it comes to HOAs? And they said, really, other than townhomes in a very narrow segment of the market, there is little consumer demand for HOAs. However, because of common property requirements during the plan unit development process, as well as throughout the development process, they're required to create HOAs to manage common property. And this is something that the home buyers don't ask for, the developers and builders don't ask for, but it's still mandated on top of that. And this could be anything from buffers and private parks, which are in addition to the public parks that our members pay for. All this is created needlessly, and it does impact housing affordability and access. At roughly today's interest rates, $100 for a month in an HOA fee is equivalent to about a $12,500 cost impact on the price of a new home. So just think about that for a moment. $100 a month for an HOA is equivalent of adding $12,500 to a new home at the price of purchase. That's really essentially adding a $12,500 new resident tax when we're creating HOAs needlessly. So we don't need to be creating these. And really what this bill does, it gets at one of my favorite adages, a pound of prevention is, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. By stopping the creation of these at the front end, we're going to see fewer HOAs, and something that I think the market is really looking for. And again, I'll just close with one simple statement. Again, you'll hear today probably from opponents of this bill that no, we're going to not have HOAs when they're required. Nothing in this bill changes Minkaya. If required under Minkaya, the HOAs will still be formed. So don't worry about any fears to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Is there any questions? All right, next on the list will be Daniel Lightfoot. Welcome, committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, the League of Minnesota Cities. The League represents the collective interests of our 841 member cities across the state of Minnesota. First, I want to appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 1268, and of course, for the conversations that I've had, that our organization has had with Representative Bonner, as well as the ability to testify before the working group itself on our support for a lot of this bill, as well as just a few concerns. First, there are a number of provisions within House File 1268 that the League is supportive of. Homeowners associations, when run effectively, are important aspects of residential development and property management that ensure the maintenance and management of private common area property and provide services and amenities to residents. The bill includes provisions that will codify best practices, provide greater transparency of information for homeowners on the requirements, procedures, and fee schedules for associations, rein in unreasonable fees, and provide alternative mechanisms for dispute resolution and other mechanisms to avoid property foreclosure, and we appreciate the inclusion of those provisions. However, the League continues to have concerns with Article 3 of the bill entitled Local Government Preemption. At least there is nothing left to the imagination on the title. While we appreciate the inclusions of the language in lines 3.10 to 3.12 of the A5 amendment, which we did discuss with Representative Bonner and Senator Lucero as well in the Senate, that amendment seeks to clarify cities' ability to ensure private common areas, streets, green space, stormwater ponds, et cetera, comply with maintenance and insurance and other requirements. However, the outright prohibition of common area property necessitating an HOA is extremely problematic, and other language in Article 3 is not, we believe, necessary and may cause confusion at best and invite litigation at worst. First, it's important to point out that the cities do not directly mandate the establishment of HOAs as a condition of approval. Cities may reference homeowners associations in development agreements to ensure that private common area created by a developer in a development is adequately maintained. Second, cities don't directly or indirectly specify terms of an HOA covenant, conditions or restrictions or governance, and we have no statutory authority to enforce private covenants between HOAs and private property. We may seek to clarify and ensure private common area property has a maintenance plan and provide evidence that an entity is maintaining that property as well as proof that it is recorded with the property, but that is largely procedural to ensure that work gets done that protects homeowners' investments with the HOA as a proactive mechanism to help maintain property. Now, the effect of the broad preemption in Article 3, Section 2, paragraph 2 includes an outright prohibition of conditioning approval of development on the inclusion of private common area property. And this could have the effect of essentially, potentially, forcing cities to accept property or infrastructure that should be private as public infrastructure maintained by the city and paid for by taxpayers. Take a stormwater pond that is completely surrounded by private property on all four sides. A developer in a development agreement could say, congratulations, cities, this is your new public stormwater pond. You're going to maintain it even though it has absolutely no nexus to something that should be public infrastructure. That said, there are some flexibilities that cities can provide to allow for things like private streets that don't adhere to subdivision standards for a right of way. But the inclusion of this private common area property, especially in the case of private streets, could allow a developer more flexibility that can lead to greater housing density. In many cities, townhome developments would be much less dense if there wasn't the flexibility for cities to allow for private streets. However, city plows can't normally fit down smaller roads not built to right-of-way standards. But if this language went into effect, we could be forced to require right-of-way standards for all townhome streets, and density would suffer because the streets would have to be wider. You wouldn't be allowed to have private common area in the form of private streets, narrower streets, and therefore we may see decreasing in density in some of these townhome provisions and lack of flexibility for developers. We're also concerned about the Article 2, Section 3 clause to be able to terminate a CIC without an adequate maintenance plan. That said, we certainly will continue conversations with this committee, with you, Mr. Chair, and members, Representative Bonner, Senator Lucero, and others in the Senate, and we do look forward to continuing to work with the author and urge that language should go further to ensure that cities aren't forced to potentially accept the management and maintenance costs of common area property at taxpayer expense, and that we retain the ability to ensure that private common area property is adequately maintained. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Thank you, Mr. Leif. Is there any questions from members of the committee? All right, thank you. Next on the list will be Aaron Brooksby. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Brooksby. I'm a licensed attorney in Minnesota. My firm represents several hundreds of homeowners associations and CICs throughout the state. About 90% of my day is spent working with boards of directors, homeowners, property managers, and doing HOA-related work. I'm here to express some concerns about the proposed bill. Unintentional consequences, as I see it. While I understand the intent of the bill and the committee is to reduce costs for homeowners, to increase transparency and solidify dispute resolution processes, I think this approach may have unintended consequences that doesn't benefit all of the homeowners. Higher costs for homeowners, enforcement challenges for the HOA, and increased difficulty in finding board members to serve voluntarily as board members. I counsel board members that fines should not be punitive. They're a tool to ensure compliance with community rules that protect property values and quality of life. Under this bill, a homeowner who knowingly violates a rule, such as a provision on short-term rentals, could treat the $100 maximum statutory fine as just a cost of doing business and wrap that into the nightly rental fee. Such a provision would become just a cost of doing business. If a homeowner makes $200 a night, that $100 maximum is not going to deter them from renting out their unit, even if it's in violation of their governing documents. The same applies to severe violations like unauthorized commercial use, illegal construction, or ongoing and severe nuisances. With ineffective fines, homeowners associations and CICs will have no choice but to pursue legal action instead, which means an increase in attorney's fees and legal fees, which who do you think will pay? If the bill is capping attorney's fees to a certain extent, which means that all of the other homeowners that aren't in violation will end up paying those costs. Homeowners associations are funded by its members. They don't have individual funds. And so all of the homeowners who are not in violation will end up paying those costs. The other thing I want to talk about is the chilling effect on board members. Board members are volunteers who take on the difficult role of enforcing their community standards. It's already hard to find homeowners who are willing to serve on their boards. I attend HOA annual meetings routinely and often observe situations where there is no homeowner who will stand up and volunteer as a board member is leaving. This bill will make it even harder by adding unnecessary hurdles for HOA board of directors, like requiring board members to personally meet with a violating homeowner before taking any adverse action against them. I've worked with board members and boards that agonize over difficult decisions, taking months to decide whether or not to foreclose on extremely large past due accounts. Now, if this bill passes as written, they'll be required to sit across from a violating homeowner and tell them that the association intends to do something to enforce their governing documents face-to-face before they can do anything. This added burden, I believe, will discourage homeowners from volunteering. Beyond the opposite of what is intended, to reduce costs of living in HOAs, the bill, I don't believe, addresses the actual underlying issues with HOAs. The reality is that most homeowners association disputes don't stem from excessive fines or overly strict rules. They happen because most homeowners don't fully understand what it means to live in an HOA community. They don't understand their rights or their obligations. That is the case with some board members. That is the case with some property managers. Supporters of this bill argue that it fosters affordability, but in reality, it forces HOAs, whether they need these policies or not, to spend thousands of dollars on legal and administrative costs to comply with the bill. The current law that's in place right now, it gives associations flexibility to create rules and policies that work for their communities. By forcing a one-size-fits-all approach, this bill disregards the 86% of homeowners who live in HOAs who are happy with their HOA, just to address the concern of that 14% that is unhappy. Instead of restricting HOAs in ways that will increase costs and weaken enforcement, we should focus on better education, helping homeowners understand their rights and responsibilities so that disputes are minimized in the first place. The ombudsperson bill that is being presented, I think, has strong legs to be able to do that. In conclusion, I urge this committee to reconsider this bill and potential unintended consequences. I also urge the committee to consider targeted reforms that enhance homeowner protection without undermining the ability of the common interest communities to function effectively. The best-run homeowners associations operate with transparency, fairness, and a clear ability to hold homeowners accountable for their obligations and to enforce the community's rules. If passed as written, HF 1268 will shift costs of law-abiding homeowners, making community management more difficult and discourage people from stepping up to serve. I'd be happy to meet with any member of this committee to discuss specific provisions or ideas that align with the committee's intent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Brooksby. Is there any questions for the testifier? All right. Next on the list will be Matt McNeil. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Igo, Vice Chair Dasseth, and esteemed Housing and Finance Committee members, I really appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony today regarding House File 1268. My name is Matt McNeil, and I'm the president at Cities Management. Cities Management is an associate company that currently manages 272 common interest communities, and we represent 17,812 homeowners. Our portfolio encompasses a diverse range of housing types, everything from planned communities, single-family homes, townhomes, condominiums, senior cooperatives, and modular housing. We serve clients spanning a wide geographic area from Wisconsin to St. Bonifacius, St. Cloud to Faribault, with home values ranging from $38,000 to well over $5 million. Cities Management is one of four associate companies operating in Minnesota, alongside Associa Minnesota, Sudler Property Management, Century Management, and collectively we represent more than 50,000 homeowners throughout the state. As North America's largest community management firm, Associa has over 300 offices across the country, and we serve over 7.5 million homeowners. Outside of my role at Cities Management, I've served over a decade on a board of 413 units of common interest community. I'm currently a condominium homeowner, and full disclosure, I am not on the board, nor does my firm manage that community. So I offer a variety of perspectives related to the bill. I'm also a Minnesota Housing Maddox Portfolio Manager of the Year winner with contributions and continued commitment to the housing industry and this commitment towards affordable housing. Members will find our written testimony in which we provided perspective, requested clarification, and offered suggestions on our experience with clients in Minnesota and best experiences and practices we've had nationwide. As Representative Bonner indicated, there's been movement of this across the country, and we certainly bring a lot to the table in terms of our experience in markets like New Jersey, Virginia, and Colorado. Our shared interest as a management company is sustainable and affordable ownership-occupied housing. We as an organization are taking a firm and unequivocal stance against any types of inducements, under-the-table incentives, compensation that promotes pay-to-play engagements,
or lacks transparency that is tied to a percentage of fines collected. Such practices are fundamentally unethical and erode trust, fairness, and the collaborative spirit essential for building a strong and principled community. As an organization, we are committed to integrity and transparency in all of our dealings and reject compensation structures that compromise those values. The language that's been put forward in the amendment heard earlier regarding conflicts of interest on its face restricts the ability of the association and the board of directors to enter into contracts over $2,000 and will immediately increase operating expenses for common interest communities, large, small, managed, and self-managed. Further, the amendment conflicts with standard conflict of interest rules for nonprofit corporations. We believe that the most common sense solution be that 515B maintain alignment with 317A here and throughout the statute, but specifically 317A-255 to ensure consistency in conflict of interest standards directors of nonprofit corporations. Based on the variety of communities we serve, the engagement we have with various boards of directors, and the engagement they have with the management organization, the restriction offered here will have an immediate impact, increasing expenses for individual owners. At scale, organizations like Associa offer significant depth and resources to our communities that reduce expense at a competitive, best-in-class partners. Our contract transparently discloses all that we use and all of those partners that we have, reiterated to the board of directors and its members at the time the board or the corporation requests bids. To be clear, our shared interest as a management organization is a healthy and financially sustainable community. We come to work every day to provide a positive and meaningful impact in the communities we serve, and I stand by that commitment. I sincerely appreciate your time. I look forward to visiting with more of you throughout the course of this bill moving forward.
Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you. Next on the list will be Patrick Hines. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer. I represent the Community Associations Institute, which is a trade organization that represents the interests of homeowner associations, from residents and board members to property management companies, lawyers, contractors, and everyone else who works with HOAs. I hesitate to say this because I know colleagues in the room will tease me about it, but I'm going to say it because it's true. I am proud to represent HOAs. There's over 1 million Minnesotans living in them. There's over 8,000 HOAs, all of which have to have volunteer board members devote their time to trying to manage their communities. I know I can look around the room and see individuals who are volunteer board members, most of whom step up not because it was their dream to do this after work, but because it's an obligation that they felt compelled to take on to better their communities. So I do think that the HOA model is successful in Minnesota. You have over 1 million people, so there are going to be disputes, I guarantee that. Some of those disputes will be caused by overzealous board members. Some of those disputes will be caused by unreasonable residents. And some of them will be there simply because disputes happen when you have people living in a common community. So I want to thank Representative Bonner and the other legislators who've worked on this issue. We've had many discussions about the language, trying to refine the language so that whatever comes out of this legislative session is something that everyone can be proud of and everyone can feel it will better association living in Minnesota. CAI has a long history of working with legislators and stakeholder groups on doing this, and we're going to continue to do that. I don't want to get into great detail. I know there are other people here to testify. I would just say, as a general matter, I do get concerned that we end up swinging the pendulum too far sometimes when we are responding to complaints of individual homeowners or trying to apply a law to 1 million people based on the experience of a handful. That doesn't mean the law shouldn't adapt with the times or be changed, but there are unintended consequences, and I'll just pick a couple from the bill. There's a restriction on the use of proxy votes. It would limit proxies to 20% of no vote could use more than 20% proxies. I understand there's a concern of board members harvesting proxy votes, but in the real HOA world, it would be almost impossible to get any business done if you limited the number of proxies. Anyone who's been on an HOA knows very few people come to the meetings, and you need those proxy votes just to pass a budget or to do basic things. So I think that's something that can be refined. There's been a lot of discussion about foreclosure, and I think that discussion is important. We worked with legal aid and legislators the past 2 years and added guardrails in MCIOWA to protect homeowners from foreclosure, giving them opportunities to make sure they can stay in their homes. One of the provisions in here would prevent foreclosure unless the homeowner was in arrears for at least 180 days and had over $5,000 owed. If your monthly dues are $250, you could simply not pay your dues for an entire year, and the association still would not be able to foreclose on your unit if you just refuse to pay. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be the norm, but if there are people who do that, the costs that that person has put onto the association have to be borne by someone, and the only place where it's borne is by the other residents. So provisions like that, if they swing too far, are going to create a lot of problems for residents. And I think we just need to be careful about how we craft these things so that we have protections for residents and also protections for their neighbors, who oftentimes have to bear the price for these disputes. So again, very happy to be here today. Thank you for the time. If you have questions now or during the hearing, I'm happy to help answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Bonner. My name is Bruce Glavin for the record. I've been a lobbyist here for over 30 years, and this is the first time I've ever appeared in front of a committee on a personal matter, so I don't represent anybody today. I'm helping a friend out who was on a condo board. I also was a condo owner for 11 years, and I was president of our board for 8 of those years. 8 long years at that part. But in all seriousness, my friend appeared on the working group as a public witness back in December, I think it was December 6, and raised an issue on governance when you self-manage. And it's not in the bill. I'm hoping for an amendment here. And I know enough after being around these years to talk to the author of the bill. I did not catch up with her yesterday, or Representative Mecklen was kind of chaotic yesterday. But I did approach Senator Lucero and did get a draft amendment from Senate Council late yesterday afternoon. It wasn't ready for this hearing, but probably more appropriate at the next stop, being it's about governance for judiciary. But essentially, the issue is this. When you have a small self-managed association, the board members end up handling the stuff, whatever it might be. It might be a downed tree. You might have the hot water heater go out. So when you have a management company, call the management, who's ever taking care of your place. When the water heater goes out, the board has to handle it. And so either I did, or I'd call up one of my colleagues and say, we got to get the emergency call over here. Question is, though, is that a meeting of the board? If you have a 3-member board and 2 people get together, do we have to give notice of that meeting? And do we have to take minutes? And so the amendment I worked on, and at least this is the concept language, would be if you're a small association, if you have 25 units or less, your budget is small, and you self-manage, you don't have to give notice of a board meeting and take minutes if you're handling management issues. If you're doing governance, adopting a budget, Mr. Hines said, setting dues, those kind of things, you'd have a full meeting in front of everybody, and you'd have no minutes and so forth. But if you're doing management stuff and you're a board member, the concept is to be excused from the formal notice and minute meeting taking. And so perhaps by judiciary I'll have that together, and I'll certainly work with both authors here and the Senate on that. But that was the issue I wanted to raise to the committee today.
Thank you, Mr. Glavin. Is there any questions? Thank you. Next on the list will be Andrew Moulton.
Yeah, Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Long-time listener, first-time caller, definitely underdressed. My name is Andrew Malton. I'm one of the owners of Advantage Townhome Management. We manage a little over 100 associations all in the metro area, been in business over 20 years. So my perspective is coming from that viewpoint. I'm going to end up reiterating a little bit of sentiment that others before me have said because I think it's important. I definitely like the intent of the bill. Certainly, I don't think anybody's against transparency or for conflicts of interest. My concern is in its current written format. As Mr. Brooksby mentioned, it is going to cause an increase to the compliant owners because they are going to pick up the share of costs that cannot be assessed back to the non-compliant owners. And that's listed multiple places through here in various formats. I didn't come with necessarily a speech prepared, but I do have notes based on this bill. I'd like to just touch on maybe a few of the ones that I think are maybe more important. But certainly if I extend my time too long, let me know. One thing I want to point out is that the bill itself was about 55 pages. I think I found issues with about 19 of those 55 pages. So I definitely have concerns of this bill in its current format. So Article 2, Section 4, lines 12-20 talks about the association must prepare a plain language explanation of the current declaration, articles of incorporation. You might as well ask the board to build a rocket that's going to go to Saturn because I don't know that this is truly possible. If this is a plain language version of the bill, I'm curious what a plain language version of the governing documents would be. I think that's extremely difficult. I think they're written in a format that is succinct. I do understand that they can be hard to interpret. I just don't know that an association's ever going to be able to adopt a plain language version, although I'm sure there's some attorneys that would love to charge a fee to do so, probably in the range of $20,000. Again, impact to current compliant owners. One of the things in the bill, Article 2, Section 4, talks about removing interest. HOA dues are like state taxes. To my knowledge, Minnesota charges interest on delinquent taxes. I don't see why an HOA wouldn't charge interest on delinquent dues. The dues are there to provide the services of the association. When they're not paid on time, again, the compliant owners are the ones footing the bill for the additional cost. The HOA should certainly be able to charge interest on amounts owed. Otherwise, it's a free loan to the owners that are not paying on time. One of the other big concerns I have here is there's some static numbers in here. There's a mention of a late fee not in excess of $15. You know, I've helped many associations rewrite their governing documents. I would never, ever suggest they put a hard number in their documents, such as dues will always be $300. The minute you put a static number in here like this, this document's going to be dated within 2 years. $15 may be reasonable right now for a specific association. It's definitely not reasonable for all associations, and it's not going to be reasonable for any associations in 10 years from now. The same holds true with the fine limit of $100 for a violation. Even attorney's fees, $1,500. I think $1,500 was listed as the limit of attorney's fees. In some cases, real-world scenario, the association has a leasing restriction and a unit owner decides to lease their unit. In some cases, the association has a right to evict that tenant. There's no way that's going to happen for $1,500 of legal fees. And if that's the most the association can charge, the compliant owners are paying that cost. As Mr. Brooksby mentioned, the rental fee. So again, $100 as a limit on an illegal rental with a limit not to exceed $2,500. Absolutely, people are going to do that as a cost of doing business. They're going to rent in a community that doesn't allow rentals. They'll pay $2,500 up front. Here's the most you can charge me in fees. I'm good. I can rent now forever. It's just not going to be enforceable.
Mr. Malzin, I just want to say to you, if you're going to be paging through the bill, we don't have time to go through all those. So because I got more testifiers on the list, we do need to get through.
Sounds good. I will touch on maybe one or two more that I feel are important.
Okay. Make it brief. Thank you.
Yep. So one that I feel is a procedural error, and talks about amending the bylaws. And this is Article 2, Section 6, lines 2027, 2028, 2029. And it mentions that any bylaw in effect may be revoked by a majority of the vote of the unit owners at a board meeting. That's not how bylaws get amended. Bylaws get amended by a vote of the members, typically by mail or maybe at a members meeting, not a board meeting. What this would allow in its current format is the board could be the only unit owner showing up at a board meeting. The board could vote to amend their bylaws to say, we now have five-year terms, add different powers to the board. I mean, this is a procedural error for sure that should not pass in its current format. Another section talks about documents provided for an annual members meeting, mentioning that the budget should be provided and allow members to be able to provide input on the budget. The annual members meeting does not necessarily time with budget adoption. Most associations run a calendar fiscal year. I have associations that have annual meetings in May. So that budget is adopted back in November. I don't know why they would present, you know, maybe they'll present the budget at the annual meeting, but it's already been in force now for 5-6 months. And then you're going to take feedback on it at that point. It just doesn't make sense. Okay, with respect to time, I definitely appreciate it. And again, I really appreciate the opportunity to testify here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next on the list will be Lynn Borgeroff. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lynn Borgeroff. I speak to you as a president of the HOA Leadership Network. I have 9 years experience as a HOA board president. I founded the HOA Leadership Network because I needed to meet and wanted to meet the board members of other associations. We're the largest membership organization for HOA board leaders in Minnesota. We have approximately 1,060 members. We hold monthly meetings, educational meetings. We estimate that there are 3,800 HOAs, condominium and townhome style HOAs in the metro area, about 197,000 housing units, and perhaps 15,000 board leaders who are volunteers, like I was. When we volunteer, we accept a significant amount of authority and fiduciary duty through MCIOWA and through our governing documents. Board leaders need and want to be successful. We have a shared purpose with the work group and with your legislative efforts because we value the increases in transparency and accountability and fairness. And we also value homeowner rights and responsibilities, and our board members work to achieve those. We want to find a balance between what's needed to sustain the association, what's needed to protect and maintain a good living situation for our homeowners. There are some provisions in the law which we would find very favorable. First would be the transparency and association management, bidding and contracting. That would allow boards to make better informed decisions. The provision of scheduled fees and fine and fee schedules, publishing of fines policy, collections policies, those are all best practices, and they are promoted through our organization, and then they are found in many associations already. The concerning provisions relate to putting caps on fines, fees, liens, foreclosure activities. And as it's been mentioned, HOA's income comes from homeowner association assessments, usually paid as monthly dues. When those are not paid, when there's delinquent homeowners, those costs continue, and those costs must be paid, so they're boards need the provisions to recover those funds. The challenge is to do it in a fair way following due process. And that is something that we do promote to our members and we find valuable in the legislation. In the interest of time, I'd like to just say that the bill emphasizes the significant need for education among board leaders and among homeowners. And actually also among realtors and association management companies, there's plenty of opportunity to improve understanding. Homeowners would benefit from certain provisions in this legislation, and to that effect, we would support the legislation. Unfortunately, some of the provisions place limitations on the boards, which we believe will limit their fiduciary duty, which is to maintain and protect the property. And if they cannot collect unpaid dues, if they can't continue with the collections procedures, for example, the association will come into even more financial difficulty. That's my comments, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeroff. And I think that concludes all of our members on the list. Is there any members from the public that wish to testify?
Thank you, Chair.
We had two people standing up, so if you want, you can take a seat there in the back, and then we'll introduce one at a time here.
I've never been at one of these before, so I'm not sure if I have to say something.
So just scoot up.
Yep, so welcome to committee. All you have to do is just introduce yourself for the record, and then you can continue with your testimony.
Okay, my name's Catherine Craig, and I'm at a homeowners association. Do I have to say the name of it? Should I? Okay. I'm treasurer there, and I can attest that it's very difficult to get people to volunteer and that the work is difficult. I mean, I spend quite a bit of time looking at the minutiae of the bank statements and who's being assessed and how we're collecting funds. And I can tell you that it's very burdensome because we have a proportion of people who have not been paying their assessments. And it has been very difficult this last year with the huge increase in insurance costs that we had to struggle to get enough money to pay just our general bills of getting the garbage picked up and the lawns mowed. And we had to pore over how to, which bills to pay and which ones not. And so while I realize you're trying to protect people that maybe struggle to pay their dues, they live here, and we all have to be a community and contribute. And so I don't know, this doesn't seem to have much of a solution for things that are really economic circumstances that are beyond homeowners' control, that have to do with the greater economic situation in the world. And I realize some people suffer from it, but we do have a duty as a board to look after all of the homeowners and keep the community viable. And if you have a group of people that just won't pay, and your rules seem to make it more difficult to get them to pay, that I don't know how that helps make homeowner associations viable in the future. That's it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Craig. All right, Nick, please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome to committee.
Hi, thank you. My name is Linda Dingbaum. I am the president of my homeowners association. I've been on it for 20 plus years, holding all of the positions. I've lived in my townhome for 33 years. When I first got on the board, we were in dire straits. We have a pretty big townhome association, 276 units on 36 acres. We have 36 buildings, 9 lots. We have a lot of amenities, outdoor pool, tennis courts, dog run, gazebo, things like that. When I first got on the board, we couldn't pay our bills. We were $60,000 in arrears, and we were literally to the point of not being able to have garbage picked up because we couldn't pay the bills, because I did some analysis. Less than half the homeowners paid their dues by the middle of the month, even though they were due on the first. Previous boards had not understood that they needed to reserve money for future projects, so we were in dire straits. So we got together as a board, and we put in some pretty stiff policies, meaning pay by the first, otherwise there's a late fee. It's the standard late fee, $35. $15 is, in my opinion, not enough to be a deterrent. And I can say 20 years later, even though those were painful, we did end up having a special assessment because there was no other way to do it. but I don't want to ever go through that again because it was difficult. But 20 years later, we're financially stable. We have our reserves relatively well funded. When I read this bill, I was concerned because a lot of the tools that we use to get where we are today, which is very, very healthy, are going to be gone. I agree with not some of the other people that have spoken have said, you know, don't put limits on it because those limits are not appropriate for every association and they may be outdated soon. I agree with that. The other thing that I think is really important to consider is that we only have one source of income, and that's dues. What a lot of people that buy in HOAs don't understand is there is no HOA big bad corporation. A lot of people think the HOA is this big bad corporation. It's not. The HOA is simply your neighbors. We're a group of people. The association brings in, collects payments, and we pay common expenses. That's it. And because we live in very close proximity, we do have rules to make it pleasant for everyone. And so I think education is extremely important. People don't understand. They want the benefits of living in an HOA, but they maybe don't understand the rules, even though they agreed to the rules and they need to understand the rules. And maybe they don't understand the responsibilities. Like right now, we have a $50,000 loss assessment on our insurance. I know for a fact. Even though we've told our homeowners many, many times, we have a lot of homeowners that have $1,000. And so, and we don't have any choice in that $50,000. And insurance has been outrageous. It's just gutted our budget. And so we don't have any choice but to raise the dues. I also want to talk just for a moment about board members. It is extremely difficult to find board members. Board members are beaten up by homeowners. If homeowners are allowed, and there's one point in here that homeowners are allowed to participate in a board meeting, that's going to cause a lot of problems. Homeowners are observers to a board meeting, just like you know, people in this room are observers, not necessarily participants. If homeowners participate in board meetings, we're going to have 7-hour board meetings that are non-productive. So I just think that there's some things that need to be run very much like Congress runs. We're basically a really tiny little piece of Congress. And so I just wanted to point out some of my thoughts from somebody that's on the ground in the trenches that's done this for a very long time. I do think there's a lot of good protections in the bill, but I also think that had this been in force, our hands would have been tied and we would be in a very different place today than we are now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Dingbaum. All right. If there's no one else from members of the public who wish to testify, we got one more. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Janae Hoffman, and I'm actually a property management company as well. I do agree with a lot of what's in here to help protect homeowners. However, I'm wondering if there's a different aspect or a way to look at this. Some of the things I see, like putting a cap on the management contract and being able to allow for that out, it's on there just for the management company. But what about the other vendors that these associations get into contracts with and can't get back out of those contracts for a period of time? I have one that's actually with an elevator company, and we've been trying to get out of it for 3 years. So limiting it just to the management company, that doesn't help. Let's see here. There was a couple other notes. My other question is association dues are part just like your property taxes and your insurance. Why can't they be part of your escrow? When you pay your mortgage, why can't you pay your association dues at that same time? And that would help homeowners, especially when they're on a fixed budget, to know that's what they're paying. It goes into their escrow. Now their association dues are paid, and it limits the other concern and or issue with associations not getting the funds. The other portion of this is you have in here for $5,000, or wondering if it was possible to look at that as opposed to it saying $5,000 and 180 days, just say $5,000 or 180 days. Because once homeowners get to a certain extent and they are delinquent, it ends up causing more hardship because they can't catch up. If you're working out a payment plan with somebody that's only 6 months behind, it's easier to do than when they're a year and a half behind. There's just no end in sight for them. We take a lot of pride in what we do and making sure that we can work with all the homeowners, but when some of these aspects of the bill that are laid out, I think it's going to put a lot more hardship on those homeowners that are abiding and following the rules and enjoy the association living.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Any other members from the public that wish to testify? All right, with that, we will go into member discussion. First on the list will be Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representatives. A number of people have, the last number of people that testified, bring up a lot of the concerns I have about this. Some of the things that's, I'm starting to listen to it, and it almost seems like the responsibility that is going to be put on these members is like an attempt to not get members to volunteer, which then would dissolve the HOAs, which then the concern is who takes over at that point. Are the cities ready to start taking over the responsibility of the HOAs to mow and plow and do all that stuff? Because the question I have in one of them specifically on the annual report must be prepared and signed by each member of the board of directors. Does that mean they are going to have to do their own research on everything that the HOA put together? And if they sign off on that, are they liable for if there's some information that the HOA put on there incorrectly? And if so, then are you going to be looking at members taking out umbrella insurance in case they get sued for whatever reason? The other thing, too, is here is no board member or the spouse, sibling, child, or parent of any board member may have a financial interest in a business that's the association or property. I don't know, you know, I think it gets to a point that you know everything. Maybe your son has started a landscaping business or is, you know, owns an HVAC company that ends up hiring with that association. Are you constantly aware with an adult child, what their business is doing? So how are you able to enforce that, and who gets in trouble with that? Is it because the kid didn't tell the parent and the parent didn't tell the association, or which way should do? So I do have concerns about that. And then
Representative Johnson, might be best to answer a couple of the questions to start so we can keep them in sync here. So
she was right.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I think, quite frankly, the first piece I will say is the signing the annual report. I mean, I think that's really about accountability for board members. And I think that's a pretty obvious best practice, pretty low bar. I'm not sure about that particular. In terms of liability, I believe the law currently has some pieces in it that actually protect board members from liability, if I'm not mistaken, and we could certainly ask nonpartisan if necessary, but I believe that is already baked into the law. This provision would not change that, so I just want to be clear about that. We are very clearly understanding of the fact that we need to make sure that individuals who are willing to step up and serve on the board are not having to face personal liability challenges. That is certainly not the intent of the law. And I don't believe this bill does that. I believe that's already covered in statute. In terms of the conflict of interest restrictions, what we have seen across the state is, and I just want to be clear that a lot of what's the recommendations that have come in this bill are there because we saw very specific themes that played over and over and over. Every time homeowners came before us, every conversation we had, some of the same themes would emerge. Conflict of interest in particular, just to be clear, we had someone come from the National Council of State Legislators to testify before us and talk about conflict of interest and HOAs. My understanding is that Minnesota is one of only a handful of states that do not currently have a conflict of interest statute relating to HOAs and CICs on the books. This is essentially remedying that particular oversight. So I think that's long overdue. And not only that, when we heard from people across the state, we heard consistently that there were very blatant conflicts of interest. And we're not talking, you know, a little willy-nilly here. It was pretty obvious. On top of that blatant conflict of interest, we were hearing a lot of situations in which associations were not able to get competitive bids. They were not able to have any transparency into where those bids were coming from. They had no ability or oversight into any of that. And let's be very clear about what an HOA board is. What we've essentially done in creating an HOA and creating an HOA board is we've created another level of quasi-government. That is what we've done. That's all of us sit in these seats. And I will be up front. Not everybody wants to sign up to be a legislator, right? It's a tough job. It's why folks hire us to handle these crazy little details about things like transportation budgets and how we build the roads and bridges and how we handle HOAs. So I understand that being a board member is difficult. And our intent here is not to make life difficult. In fact, part of what we went through here is to really put those sort of common sense, reasonable guardrails in place to actually help make it more clear for boards and associations what their roles and responsibilities are, what they need to do. And right now, what we hear consistently from board members and from folks who serve across the state, from homeowners, is that what those roles and responsibilities are not really clear. They're not transparent. And so what a lot of we're doing here is really addressing those issues. And I will leave it there. I don't know, Representative Mecklen, if you have additional feedback you wanted to provide on those three questions.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner did a pretty good job covering all this, but it was in hearing some of the testimony today, this was not necessarily things that we necessarily heard as much that those voices may not have been heard as often. The patterns that we did hear often were frequent, and as it's been stated before, 86%, right, are very happy with their HOAs, which means there's 14% that's not. So this isn't like one of those situations where you're talking about a few people, because that represents well over a couple hundred thousand Minnesotans. And when there's the patterns were, if it was one or two, I'd consider it a one-off, but this was very frequent, and it wasn't just in any one region of the state either. It was everywhere. So one of the things, every year I'm required to go to continuing ed. I got to pay to sit in a class for 8 lovely hours. Some of it's mind-numbing, but it's to go over all new laws that were passed, new regulations, new building code, new whatever. And I don't think it needs to be anywhere near that extensive. I think a simple video put together on the Secretary of State's website or one of them to explain what their obligations are of taking that position, and then, you know, and probably one for the homeowners too, because there is some of that. I mean, there was some pretty egregious homeowner stories where you just wanted to bang your head in the computer as well. But this was a very repetitive thing, and that's where. And I believe when you mentioned the testimony that we're one of the last states, ironically, the conservative states have all implemented this.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had heard from other, you know, actually, and I was, as I mentioned before, I was on a board member, more than happy to get off because of all the calls you get and all the hassles that are associated with being a board member. But I became a board member because out of desperation, because they said, listen, we have to have a board member or we're in trouble and we possibly have to look at dissolving or whatever. So I said, I'll do it. Trying to get people to show up, and I know the big push was to do proxy votes, because you were never getting anybody to show up for those meetings, and those meetings never happened if you didn't have those proxy votes. Another violation. I don't know if we're supposed to go drag those people out of their homes to show up to these meetings. We made it about as fun as you could possibly have, cookout, whatever. You still don't show up. So my concern is, if you're going to make it harder and harder, when we're doing everything we can to get people that's easier and easier to participate, volunteer, what happens to these HOAs when they dissolve because they can no longer meet their criteria because people are saying it's not worth it? And these, and then it goes back onto these cities that start doing, every development now has areas that have to be taken care of in common area. Are we expecting the cities just to start taking over that then?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I will tell you, right now, the system as it is, there are HOAs who are already there. And I'm just being clear. They are frustrated. They are not getting what they need. And so realistically, I would like to see us have some, you know, for example, in this particular section, we talked about the idea of some doing some more around conflict of interest, for example, dispute resolution, and specifically I want to make sure I correctly put it in here, in section 13, where we talked about regular meetings and conference, and that was really about dispute resolution. And the point of that is to say, how do we have both an ability to do some sort of early resolution before it escalates and it gets out of control, before the fines and fees get out of control, before we end up having to send people to collections and foreclosure and all of the things? How do we address the issue of bad behavior? You might have noticed some language in the amendment that specifically had a right to cure around bad behavior. And that was those situations that were brought up where, what happens when somebody continually does the same thing over and over and over again? What are our pathways, right? And how do we address those specific issues? I think having some degree of best practice, having some degree of guardrails, having some degree of roles and responsibilities built into the statute helps board members to understand better what their responsibilities are. Now, I will tell you, we've talked a little bit about education and training in this today and how we get to a better place in that respect. There isn't a great way to do that in this policy bill in and of itself. One of the things that I will tell you is that we have talked about an Office of the Ombudsman. And it is our hope that the Office of the Ombudsman would have the authority to help assist folks to figure out, how do we put a set of bylaws in plain language? How do we assist with dispute resolution? How do we help with creating those best practices and making sure that folks across the state are aware of their roles and responsibilities as homeowners? All of those bits, right, that we don't really have a home for today. We'd really like to do that, but we know that those pieces are going to require money. We are very clear about that, and that is why they are not traveling in this bill. And I like to liken this as a project manager to sort of phase 1.0, right? This is sort of the laying the policy framework. We know that other pieces will need to come. We know that we will need to be able to enforce some of these mechanisms. That will have to travel separately because of the budget impacts. And that is the case for across the board. So we are very well aware that this bill is not the end of the line. It is not the end all be all. It will not solve all of the world's problems, but it is the start to build a foundation of those guardrails for consumer protections. And it is the foundation of sort of those roles and responsibilities for boards. Do we understand that there are probably some things we're going to need to tweak ahead? Absolutely. You probably noticed during this, I was taking vigorous notes, right? And to bring that back to all four co-authors and have a conversation, I heard some really good suggestions today from folks. And I, for those folks who didn't already reach out to us in advance, I think those who have will tell you we've been very open to suggestions. If you have suggestions for language changes, if you have suggestions for how to improve a particular section, please write to us, bring it to us. We will discuss it. We meet all together, Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate, and we hash through every single question. We seek out advice and counsel to make those. And we are more than happy to make improvements to this bill and make it better. So if you have suggestions on how to make this better, please bring them. We are open.
Thank you, Representative Bonner.
Thank you.
Next on the list will be Vice Chair Dotsoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, I think a lot of the questions have gotten answered, so thank you. For the larger associations, are they still allowed to have their on-site maintenance teams in place?
I don't think there's anything.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair. I don't believe there's anything specific that prevents that. I would say that depends on how they're hired or what they do. Some boards hire a maintenance team directly and they set up those vendor contracts on their own. Some go through a property management company. It would probably vary depending on the board and whether they have a property manager, how they do that.
Vice Chair Dotsoff.
Follow-up question. How about in the event of an emergency? Is there any special processes for the association to hire in the event you have a roof that blows off and they have to get a group in right away and actually repair the roof? Is it going to require a bidding process, or can they grab someone from their own team to actually get that done?
Does that Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dotsoff, typically, from my experience, we call in there's many people who do emergency response, so that what you're describing is perhaps a tree on a roof or something to that effect, or it needs to be temped in with a tarp. I don't think anything is like that is addressed in this. I mean, as far as there's emergency response in pretty much every area. I don't think we have actually put any limitations on anything of that nature.
Okay. Next on the list is Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. It's the irony to this is I was just purviewing, looking through things, and the glaring issue that every time I kept looking, I'm like, where is, you know, the lien for assessments, the enforcement action, preventing foreclosure, these sort of things. And I started reading deeper, and I came to the same conclusion that the testifiers are, that if you don't have a bite, if you don't have a reason, they're going to – I've been in retail and renting my whole life, not housing, snowmobiles and trinkets and stuff. But what I found out is when people have the opportunity and they know they can get away with it, they get away with it. And for the individual that figures it out and says, you know, $100 a month or $300 a month, whatever, it's cost of doing business, I'm just going to do that. And it kind of poo-hoos the whole thing then, because everyone else is covering it. And then there's this massive, what everyone's talking, everyone just throws their hands up and says, why are we doing this? This is crazy. And is there going to be a way to put some teeth into it for those individuals that think that they can continue to go on page one of A5, except when the violation is repeated, willful, and knowing violation, and the owner has been given notice, the fine will be increased due to the repeated nature of the violation. Then the fine may be up to 300. And again, there's got to be something else other than the money fine, because if they don't want to pay it or if they can't afford to pay it, then everyone else is paying. And do you want those people in your association? Do you want them there if they're that willing and knowingly? I know you don't want to prevent the foreclosure. You want to prevent that. But that has to be somewhere on the table. That has to be there. Because what's your answer? Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I just want to be crystal clear. This bill doesn't stop you from being able to foreclose. You can. It sets some limitations, but it doesn't say you can't. And, you know, I think we all know that if you are consistently doing what you're suggesting, at some point you're going to get a foreclosure notice. That's going to happen, right? Now, maybe this buys you a little time before you get the foreclosure notice for the bad actors, and that's certainly possible, but it also buys time for the folks who are not bad actors. And, you know, when we talk about the foreclosure piece in particular, the reason you see some basic items put in there is that we were seeing things like folks coming forward and saying, I'm 100% up to date on my dues. I pay it every single month via auto pay. I got a foreclosure notice with 30 days notice for $56. $56. They are threatening to foreclose on someone's house. And I think there is no one in this room who would believe that that was reasonable or that that was appropriate, right? Like, come on, $56. Not to mention, when we talk about dispute resolution, no one could have picked up a phone to find out if this person is paying their bill every month on time. There's no one that could have said, hey, we've noticed you have this fine out here. Did you want to take care of this? You know, and I will tell you personally, I had been managing the relationship with the association for on behalf of my brother many years ago. And I did for several years. And he, because of the nature of his work, he was often gone for a long time. He was gone for repeated areas. We kept asking about having the notifications to be sent to me with his permission. No, we couldn't do it. We went round and round and round. And I said, I finally got a hold of an actual person. And I said to them, if you can tell me what you need, I can get that handled for you right now. We don't need to go through this thing about the attorney fees. We don't need all the nonsense. I am more than happy to be that person and to make sure that the buck stops here and you get what you need to run your association. And I think there are many cases where we see that it's really that simple. And we've heard many of those stories. And that's not always happening. And so we are trying really hard to strike a balance here between how do we protect homeowners from, you know, really crazy things like $56 for foreclosure, and yet also balance the idea of we do need to understand that homeowners associations, some of them don't have huge margins, right? They live on those margins. They still have to pay the lawn company and the guys to remove the snow and all of the things, right? And we get that. And so this is really an attempt to try to find a way to strike that balance of what's reasonable.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Very brief, Representative Scraba.
Don't you think that's what the board's job is then? To take that repeat person that's constantly doing it and the board says, your time is up, or the board, your brother's case, $56, where's this coming from? I think there's some responsibility to the board here, and I'll let you go, but that's just my two cents.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Bonner.
Well, thank you, because that specific part about dispute resolution is exactly for that reason, is to say, board members, this is your responsibility, right? And we need you to step up and find a way to help make that happen. And so I appreciate the vote of confidence on that section of the bill.
Next on the list will be Representative Rerar.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have a comment and then two quick questions, hopefully. First of all, I just want to reiterate a little bit of what was previously shared. Listening to these testifiers today, please know that we know the majority of these association boards are doing things very well. I think you said it was 86% are satisfied. So we're really talking about guardrails to ensure, you know, reasonability with this other 14%. And there has been some overreach with things like a $56 fine leading to foreclosure. So I was going to ask that question. I think what example it was. So I want to ask Representative Meckland if you could remind us, because I wish all the testifiers were here the day that you were able to share the working group's recommendations and why you had this working group. So I'm wondering if you could share one of those examples which made you feel strongly to support this bill.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been an ongoing percolating distrust with some people with HOAs, and it's, I think it's, they've become a bigger and bigger thing. I mean, they're obviously being used more and more, or being more and more newer developments are adopting to have them. So obviously you're going to have more upset people, but there are some. I mean, and I, one of the examples that I, and I know that some of those families, I just actually met one last weekend, but they have a municipal septic or a community septic amongst just those houses, and there's five of them all in the same kind of logistic area, and they're all getting dinged now for between $23,000 and $28,000. Now, that's fine because you got to replace your septic. What are you going to do? The problem is the investment firm that bought all five systems, they bought them for $500, literally $500 or less each, but they're only giving them 3 years to do it. So $800 to $900 a month in an additional payment, mandatory, or they will proceed with foreclosure. Number one, number two, they're not going to do the work until they have all the money, and there is, and there's no guarantee that they're actually going to do it, not just sell all this in 30 months. And I was surprised to find that there's nothing to protect these people. Like, why wouldn't you put it in an escrow account and prove you're paying it? I mean, it's these types of stories, and the fact that there's more and more really senseless requirements that were coming about from, you know, because there are some pretty interesting people who run for HOA boards. I know there's not enough of them. I get that. But there's always that one crazy grandpa guy who says you can't have your garage open more than 30 seconds. There's actually a great video on that. But it's that type of stuff.
Representative Rear.
Thank you so much. And then just one follow-up question. I appreciate that. I think it's good to hear the example. So I understand HF 1268 is only the recommendations from the working group that doesn't have a cost. So I am just wondering, on those items that came from the working group that you presented us that doesn't have a cost, does this bill language end up matching most of those things? Do you feel like you were able to put most of those recommendations into this bill?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. Yes and no. firstly, I should say there were actually almost 150 recommendations from the board. Now, we have to, we basically prioritize those items to boil them down to about 40. And the bill you see before you primarily addresses those prioritized recommendations. Now, not every recommendation made it in for very obvious reasons. There may be some where we're not quite sure how we would enforce it. We are not quite sure what the solution would be, and it might require some a deeper dive. For example, when we talk about affordability, insurance is a major concern. And I know Chair Howard and Chair Igo are well aware of this. So I've been working with staff to draft a bill that would create a task force to look specifically at the insurance issue, to make sure the right people are at the table having that conversation. So that was something that was a major theme throughout our conversations, but it was a little bit outside of the scope of the members of that work group. So That might be a reason why something that was in a recommendation did not make it into this bill. And again, it may be that those items need a little bit more solutioning or a little more finessing and a little more discussion before we could actually take action on them. And we want to be thoughtful about not trying to not put things into the legislation that we don't think we can do just yet, if it's not baked.
Lead Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief because we're short on time, but I just want to thank Representative Mecklen and Representative Bonner for bringing a really great bill based on a lot of hard work in the task force that we heard about. I think everybody in this room cares a lot about making housing more affordable for Minnesotans, and I really view this as a key part of our work to do so. And just really thank both of you for all the work that's went into it thus far and all the work that will continue to be involved in moving this really fine bipartisan piece of legislation. Thank you.
I'll just echo those comments. Thank you for all the hard work on this bill and everything you've brought together from the testimony today. And no, like you said, this is a work in progress. That's why this bill is going to be going to judiciary next and having those conversations. So appreciate both your work on it. So with that, closing comments to both of you.
I will just say a couple very quick things. I just want to say, to your point, this is a work in progress. I encourage everyone who came forward today to please seek me out. I'll give you my email address so that you can reach out and we can bring those to the group. Would be delighted. I know we've already made commitments to the city, League of Minnesota Cities, to continue to work on some of their concerns. We've already made talked to some folks about the proxy voting issue that came up. That is actually on our list of items to discuss and how to address making sure that we don't allow harvesting, but of course still give that flexibility, as well as the voting by mail. We know those are issues. We'll continue to work on those. So those are in process. We also know that there are a number of issues here, but I just want to be very clear. We at the legislature do not get involved because 86% of people are happy and living in Shangri-La. We are here specifically because, unfortunately, the 14%, which represents about 220, I think Representative Mecklen did the math, folks have started to come forward, and they have been for years, and they have said, we see a problem, we see a pattern, and we have no recourse. We have no one that can have our back. There is no one that can take action from the AG's office. There is no path open to them to handle disputes. There is no recourse for them when they have not gotten the consumer protections they need. And that is actually why we are here, is to center those Minnesotans. So I want to thank everyone for their time. Please, please come up. Reach out to me. We would love to make this bill better in every single way.
With that, I re-renew my motion that House File 1268 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Law. With that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is on its way. All right, members, that concludes our agenda for the day. We'll be back tomorrow at 3 o'clock for some more bills. Thank you for everyone's time. Enjoy the evening. We are adjourned.